And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, freshly back from killing Hitler as a baby. We'll get to that later. Everybody's saying, what? Why did he say Hitler? You'll see.
Yeah, it's foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing.
Right. Read a book.
It's not pathetic fallacy, although it might be pathetic.
Anyway. It's CFRU's Political and Current Affairs Discussion Show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can also listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we will catch up with Dr. Ben Carson, he of the Hitler reference a few seconds ago. He is now the official frontrunner in the Republican presidential race, and he's been having difficulties lately with the media vetting his background, which seems to have either a number of holes or confusing exaggerations depending on where you're coming from. Will the real Ben Carson please stand up? Then, a paper published by two Princeton economists outlined an alarming increase in the mortality rate amongst middle-aged, high school-educated white men in North America. And modern economic factors seem to be pointed at as the cause. So is this the canary in the coal mine for income inequality? We will explore that. And then finally, we will preview the upcoming climate change summit in Paris. With the new and improved Canadian government at the table, can any substantive action on climate change happen? But first, we just before we get into the first topic, we have a giveaway on the show. Scotty, what are we giving away?
We are giving away, and please call us when we're not speaking, so maybe at the bottom of the hour. But this is a bit of a heads up, and we'll announce it again at the bottom of the hour. We're giving away two tickets to the Guelph Lecture, Possibility and Imagination on Being Canadian, the Guelph Lecture at the River Run Center, 7 p.m. tomorrow night. Tickets to be picked up at the box office. We do not have the physical prize, so don't call us now. Please don't call us now. This is just a heads up. Give us a call when the tunes are on or the PSAs are on. And first caller in at 509-837-CFRU, 509-837-2378 at about 5:30 will be the winner, Gagnon.
Yes, so stay tuned for that. First, though, we will have our first topic, and that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the full text of which was released last week. And people seem to be split into two camps about it. Either it is not as bad as we thought, or it's way worse than we thought. Either way, it's now in the hands of the government of the 12 member countries who all must ratify it. Must ratify the deal if it is to move forward. So should Canada ratify? Well, let's start with our own economic commentator, Scotty Hertz, who I know has a very strong opinion of the TPP.
Oh, you betcha. So just to give people an idea, the TPP, 12 nations involved, it's going to be the world's largest trading zone. It seems there's a parallel deal trying to be worked out with it with China right now, which will include some overlap with some of the countries. I think Australia and New Zealand in particular, they're calling that the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is just like the TPP pretty much by the looks of it. So massive trade zone being created. It happened in the middle of the election that it was given the approval, but of course has to be approved by the parliaments and the governments of the countries involved. And of course, I guess our main concerns would be Canada and the U.S., of course. And will that happen? I would say the odds are excellent that it's going to happen. I can't see it not happening. There hasn't been any indicators yet, I guess because there's so much other stuff going on, which we're going to talk about later, from Trudeau and company that they're not going to ratify it. I don't think there's been any outright, no, we're not going to say yes to that. It's going to happen.
Right.
Some of the issues that are going to be huge, and as we've seen in the past, those of you, and there's lots of you out there that remember, not even NAFTA, but the original free trade deal and what happened. This seems to be a bit of an echo of that in that, and this is just my opinion, but history dictates that when we have these sorts of agreements, it pretty much, they just seem to pretty much accommodate, you know, the corporate people. And there's a lot to that, I think. In particular, the automotive industry isn't happy. The sort of percentage of cars is one thing that's going to change in terms of how much content needs to be local. That number is going to be diminished quite a bit. I think it's going to go down from 62.5% needs to be kind of locally produced or sourced down to about 45%. So, of course, when that happens, you know what happens. It's a race to the bottom. And, of course, there's lots of others. Adam, you're probably going to comment on one or two of them. Agriculture in particular is another area.
Yeah, and what's interesting is Lawrence McCauley, who's the new agriculture minister, said it's likely that he's going to support the TPP. So if you're concerned about maybe more hormones in your milk and more American milk coming in and more and other foreign dairy products, which tend to allow more, let's call them non-natural things to be used to spur growth and foster growth in cows. That is a primary concern. But yeah, it's interesting because there is a pretty loud group against the TPP. And so it makes you stop and think for a minute, you know, this might not end up being ratified. On the other hand, what we have is a lot of camps in terms of people against. There's kind of no singular anti-TPP entity. People are concerned about trade deficits, or people are concerned about labor. There's a very strong anti-temporary foreign worker group amongst you know, labor unions and such who have parts of the TPP and have figured out that it's going to make bringing temporary foreign workers in a bit easier, because the provisions in the TPP, I think the way it's set up is that companies won't have to do what they currently have to do, which is try and find Canadian workers first for these unskilled jobs. So like the Tim Hortons gigs and the McDonald's gigs and all those. So there's concern amongst labor unions about that. And then there's the intellectual property side of it. Mm-hmm. Concerning a lot of different issues, but primarily among them is public domain. Currently, the United States has the most arduous law concerning when something enters the public domain, which basically means that whoever the original rights holder is doesn't have the rights to that anymore. And basically, it is right now in the United States, it's the author's life plus 70 years. It was, like it once was in Canada and New Zealand and several of the other countries in the TPP group, was the author's life plus 50 years. But all, if any of the countries, or if all the countries, because again, they all have to sign on, or none of them get to sign on, it will be increased to the author's life plus 70 years, which is going to have a huge impact in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars on creative control and development. And then the other thing is drug prices, because there's a lot of provisions in the TPP controlling when generic drugs will be able to start producing and how many generics can be produced once the patent period is over.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, in a lot of these areas, and going back to agriculture for a minute, it might not seem like much if you've seen the numbers, but it seems that Canada is going to cede control of like 3.25% of dairy and 2.1% of poultry, which seems small.
Yeah.
And I guess when it comes to the big picture, it is small. But the thing is, what happens with these things is once the foot is in the door, mm-hmm. it's always, always subject to change. Mm-hmm. So we'll see, you've probably heard a bit about supply management, which is currently how dairy and poultry are administered in Canada, and that those producers are going to be bought out to the tune of billions. And, of course, there'll be some screaming about that, too. It's like, why are you buying these people out? It should be a free market. But, again, I mean, the supply management goes back quite a ways in terms of, you know, having a secure, steady food supply, which is very important to a lot of people. But on the other hand, and sort of related, too, is the way this deal is structured, I see it as a bit of a throwback, too, because it seems that the winners in it are the... it's commodities for the most part, like, logging, fishing. We're going back to sort of the 1867 kind of like, oh, do you want our potash? You can have it for this price. And they will always, it's true. And beef and pork are going to be huge because the markets in Asia are going to open, supposedly wide open. Now, there was supposed to be an opening of that too, but I think it was Korea shut it down to either foot and mouth, or I can't specifically remember the disease, but there are opt-outs where you can say, oh, no, you've got this, you've got mad cow, we don't want any of your stuff. So there are sort of loopholes and workarounds. But the bigger picture they're saying from this, as they said with NAFTA and the original free trade agreement, was that it should lead to more choice and lower prices. But will it? And I think as we've seen in the past, it never does. Manufacturing's been gutted. It's gone. With an agreement like this, it ain't coming back. So this is the problem I think a lot of people have in terms of the amount of control that's ceded. And also the fact that people weren't consulted. Because in deals like this, it's you don't have to go to the people right away. It's one of those things that sort of circumvents the whole parliamentary process. And there's a lot of things, you know, like, you know, the military, if you know, military assaults don't necessarily have to go through parliament, depending on what it is.
Right.
And also things like trade agreements can be negotiated. Under the Conservatives, there's so many trade agreements negotiated with countries you didn't think about off the top of your head as having a relationship with Canada, like Colombia was one. And you just say, what is this all about? So...
yeah,
that's the great question. What are we going to do?
Well, and free trade isn't necessarily bad.
It's bad if it favors corporate interests above those of the citizens.
I meant as a concept, it's not bad.
Well, it's sure,
but
it's all theoretical, right? In theory, you'll pay less.
I've seen this quoted in a number of places. The three people who benefit most from this are Big Pharma, Wall Street, and Hollywood. Now, why Hollywood, you ask? Well, that's the intellectual property thing. Why is the rule for public domain 70 years plus the author's life? Two words, Mickey Mouse. Because Disney doesn't want Mickey Mouse to get in the public domain because God knows what people are going to do when Mickey Mouse is in the public domain. But also the fact that Mickey Mouse is like the brand that built this huge mega conglomerate, which now includes, you know, a bunch of other characters.
And now they've got the Muppets, right? Disney
has Muppets, Star Wars, Marvel Comics, all its, you know, various princess characters, Pixar.
So most of the free world of entertainment for younger
people. But that's the funny thing about Disney, right? And who is one of the drivers, not necessarily the driver, but one of the drivers in terms of these economic property or these intellectual property restrictions. This is a studio that was built on the public domain. What were the first big hits for Walt Disney Studios?
Steamboat
Snow
Willie.
White.
Oh.
Mickey Mouse. Well, yeah, besides from Mickey Mouse. Snow White, Pinocchio, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, you know.
And that was when they were the only game in town. Too,
right.
And that was,
nobody owned the rights to Sleeping Beauty. Like the Brothers Grimm's estate wasn't like, you know, how dare you take bread out of our mouths, Disney? But this is... the secrecy is one of the big things to come back to, more political matters. It's a bit heartening to see, you know, Christopher Freeland out there saying, oh, yes, we want people to send in their comments and send in their concerns. Part of me wonders how much of this is too late. You know, it is an all-or-nothing proposition in terms of whether or not this gets ratified or not. But... does Canada have the heft to say, oh, we're not going to ratify it, and ergo the whole thing, the whole five-year negotiating process then has to start again from scratch? Does Canada might not have that heft, but you know who might have that heft? The United States, where you have people on both sides of the political spectrum who aren't in favor of this, or at least say they aren't in favor of it, to gain political favor, Hillary Clinton, but...
yeah. Yep, I think that's the only way we would see changes on the Canadian front is if one of the big wheels, in particular, the U.S., says we don't like this, don't like that. Mm-hmm. Then that would mean that things that we have negotiated in this, because this is how it works, it's there's sort of the blanket stuff that covers all the countries, and then there's all these kind of side deals.
Right.
And it's 6,000 pages?
Yeah.
A whole ton of that is the side deals. It's like, well, Malaysia wants this, but Australia wants this. And I'm not sure how many pages ours are, but I'm sure they're huge. Just to sort of cover everybody's interests, they need to do that. It's like doing any kind of deal like that. So...
And even then, there's been criticism that the Canadian negotiating team really didn't negotiate because they wanted to close the deal so that it would be election ready, as it were.
And yet, look how well that worked out.
Well, yeah.
Hmm. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see when this hits. When is it going to be tabled? Do you know? It's probably
I don't
not
think they've announced it yet.
Probably not until the new year.
Well, yeah.
I couldn't see it happening before Christmas. You've ruined Christmas with your TPP.
Well, I mean, the Parliament's basically going to be back for a week when it comes back in December, and that's going to be the economic update mostly, and the middle class tax cut, and just, you know, to get everybody's feet wet. And
everybody's
looking
at their smartphones, wondering when it's time to pack.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. That's anyway. The life, eh? Wow.
Anyway, we'll keep you updated on all things TPP because this ain't over. And just a final side note, you know who came out against TPP? Jim Polzilli.
Yeah, which is interesting because I see him as a kind of corporate type. But
yeah, he said signing TPP could be the worst public policy decision in the country's history.
He's still bitter about that thing with Franklin Ships, probably. That's a whole other story.
Oh, he might still be bitter about not being able to buy the NHL team, or he might be bitter that the company he built is...
That Blackberries don't really work so hot. I do love the old... I still run one because... It's a dandy little keyboard, but I mean, that's my own plug for Blackberries. Fish went out of the garbage, and they still work. It's a dandy little machine.
Speaking of dandies, I'm kidding. Anyway, Ben Carson. Ben Carson is a name you may recognize. He is running for president in the United States. He is running for the Republican nomination. He is presently, depending on what poll you looked at, the front runner or possibly a close second after Donald Trump. He is a neurosurgeon by trade. And he has an interesting story. You know, he grew up in poverty in Detroit, managed to get into Yale Medical School, became a world-class neurosurgeon, and now he is running for president. Except he's having some problems with what we like to call the truth. And in one of his books outlining his life and his times, he made a number of claims, one of which that he had... basically, subpsychotic rage as a youth. He tried to kill a friend with a knife, tried to stab him in the belly, but the darn knife broke off in the belt buckle. He then tried to hit his mother with a hammer. And there were other incidents that are somewhere in between in terms of severity, throwing rocks at a friend's head, saying he got a scholarship to West Point, saying he was in a Yale class where he was basically the last honest man. But Ben Carson is not taking this lying down. He is basically saying he is the center of a witch hunt. And it makes me curious, because there are questions about, like, past presidential candidates and writing their biographies and, you know, kind of telling tall tales or, you know, in beginning certain aspects of their life to make them seem more profound. And I think he has a point there. But on the other hand, when CNN investigators go to your childhood friends and say, hey, was Ben Carson a psycho? And they go, no, he was basically Urkel without the mad science and the...
Urkel as brain surgeon, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. Once you move further up the food chain, you're under way more scrutiny. And if you're going to be the president of the United States, I mean, all politicians fudge it a little bit. The further up they go, you know, it doesn't withstand the scrutiny. And there will be scrutiny. It's almost like, oh, he's what they call a fabulist, where he's just sort of just saying stuff. Like, I did this and that. And the thing is, you could do that in the pre-internet world, I think. You could do it a little bit easier. But now you can't, because anybody can kind of try and pursue the facts. And if CNN are doing it and other journalists are going deep into the facts. And a lot of people were disturbed by the West Point scholarship thing, because it seems... that West Point scholarships don't exist. Like, if you don't know West Point, it's the most exclusive military college in the U.S. I think it was a presidential edict or something back 200 years ago was what started it. So if you if you're going to West Point, you're the cream of the crop, but you're expected to serve. And there's a situation in the States, they call it stolen valor, where you're just sort of riding on the coattails of, you know, well, I was going to go to West Point, but I didn't go. Think of the guy in Ottawa who was wearing the medals that didn't fight at all. That's kind of like stolen valor, where you're saying that I wanted to be a soldier, but you weren't. This actually reminded me of Brian Williams. Brian Williams fibbing, where he was, you know, he was in the war zone, that's for sure. But it's like, well, we got shot at and we were shot down. You're just kind of making stuff up. And you can't do that. But the problem with Ben Carson is that there's things he says that are just... outright ridiculous, like Joseph from the Bible building the pyramids for grain. And the Egyptian antiquities people are like, we're not even going to dignify this with a response. This is like crazy town kind of stuff. And the other one in the past couple of days was the whole being gay is a choice. there was a discussion about prison and how, well, you know, people are gay by choice. This is a doctor, a brain surgeon, and he's saying such far out things that are factually incorrect, and some of them are outright lies when it comes to his history. So how do you trust this guy? He might be the nicest, and he's calm, and he has measured responses, and he's not as much of a liar as Trump. But I think if you ran the percentages, you'd see that, you know, he's out there. Space cowboy grade out there.
I don't know. I don't know about Ben Carson. You know, there's a debate on, you know, should we be focused on his fibbing about his biography, or focus on his fibbing on, in terms of the campaign trail? Because he comes out, and there's a debate on Tuesday on Fox Business Channel where he comes out against raising the minimum wage, where he says every time you raise the minimum wage, joblessness increases, which is not true, because there are numerous instances where the job rate goes up or stays steady as minimum wage increases.
More money in the community, more people spending that money.
Right.
Yeah, it's a given.
But then this flies in the face of, back in, I think it was in May, he said that minimum wage was too low, that it had to be raised. So in like the space of like 5 or 6 months, he goes from one extreme to the other. And I don't know if he forgets what he says, or if he's just like that quick on new information, or he just like acts on a single piece of new information. Like somebody handed him this thing. Well, look at this, Dr. Carson. Actually, it shows that when a minimum wage goes up, half the time jobs go down, regardless of what other factors may exist that resulted in those job numbers going down. Maybe it was in the middle of a recession or something. All right. Well, I changed my mind again. Well, higher minimum wage creates jobs.
Yeah, when you're seesawing like that, it's like no one should. Although there seems to be lots of Republicans taking this guy seriously, and I don't know if that's due to the other contenders, a la Trump and other people. But this is the problem with his policy. It seems to be that he's kind of thin on the details, and then even when there are details, they're sort of just it's up, it's down, it's whatever. Mm-hmm. Stuff like his tax plan, which he wants to base on tithing. Yeah. Tithing is a biblical concept, which is that you pay 10% to the church. Well, his is like, okay, you're paying 10% to your church. You pay 10% of whatever your wages are, small, large, minimum, or multi-billionaire, to the government. And that just doesn't hold water. If you ask any economist, they'll say that this is just ridiculous. It might work for your church or faith group.
He's just dressing up the flat tax, right?
It's a flat tax, and it's a measly flat tax. But this is the problem, is that some of the stuff is almost scarier than the lies. This policy is like, what? This is... But where it got weird, and I'd mentioned it off the top there with these guys, was who asked them a question about baby Hitler? I think it was the New York Times. They proposed this theoretical, and I don't know why. I honestly think that the New York Times are just having fun with these guys. They're really, because they're all saying, Jeb Bush is like, yes, I would definitely kill baby Hitler. But who wouldn't kill baby Hitler? But it's a ridiculous premise to begin with, right? You would say, I think that question's ridiculous. Carson, on the other hand, said he would not abort baby Hitler because it's wrong to abort anybody. So it's just taking a turn for the weird. And I honestly think the New York Times is playing with these guys. Well, but it became a thing.
You have to admire the force of his conviction, right? But at the same time, I mean, you can, like, my note here, this page of notes I have for Ben Carson, is literally filled up with his harebrained scheme. And The Guardian said, you used to be able to say the phrase, it's not brain surgery, and you would be able to be understanding that, you know, it's you know, something is easy. If it's not brain surgery, it must be relatively easy. You look at Ben Carson, you can't really say it's not brain surgery anymore. He's a brain surgeon, and it just seems he's completely out there. There was the diet supplements he said that cured his prostate cancer, but then he went and got the proper course of treatment for his prostate cancer so he could set a good example. Who thinks like that? That's nuts. Then there was the whole, well, if the, in Nazi Germany, it was gun control that caused the Holocaust because, you know, if the Jews were locked and loaded. And then there was the affair with the Popeyes where he said he almost got stuck up at a Popeyes. But then he said, no, who you really want to rob is the kid behind the counter making minimum wage, not me, Dr. Ben Carson.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, it's almost like saying that you hit a kid with a rock once is almost the... It's almost the least of it. And The thing that fascinates me, though, is the media angle and him attacking the media. Like, well, are you going to go to my kindergarten teacher and ask me what I did in kindergarten next? And it's like,
why, yes.
Maybe we should, first of all. But it was because CNN went to his campaign for comment, and his spokesperson, Armstrong Williams, sent them an email back that said, why would anyone cooperate with your obvious witch hunt? And then he signed off with Happy Halloween, because it was around Halloween time. But if you can't remember the name Armstrong Williams, in 2005, he was a regular commentator on a bunch of – he was a professional pundit. And he got zapped for accepting $240,000 to promote No Child Left Behind, which is the education plan under George W. Bush. So he took money to go on all these shows he went on to promote President Bush's education plan. So this is somebody who...
Spin doctor.
Spin doctor, not just a spin doctor, but in terms of, like, one of these, like, ultra, like, I will take money to spin anything kind of guys. It's not like he's spinning on principle. And I'm wondering how much he's getting to try and turn Ben Carson into something resembling a candidate. If he's like the face of it, Armstrong Williams, I mean, granted, if taking money to promote a political policy is the worst thing you've ever done, okay. But at the same time, it seems like a weird political decision for someone, granted, who someone isn't a politician, but is trying to be taken seriously as a politician.
But that's exactly it. It comes down to the cash.
Yeah.
When it really comes down to it, President of the United States, regardless of your party or background, it comes down to the money and who's got the most money and who has the best spin. So, I mean, maybe if it wasn't for this guy, Ben Carson might not be top of the charts because, you know, there are a lot of contenders in the Republican campaign, and you would think some of them might have a better fleshed-out resume or plan.
Yeah.
And some of them seem to. Not that I, you know... Obviously not a Republican, don't particularly like them, and can't vote for any of them, as was pointed out to me earlier today, and that's fine. But it's always interesting to follow the process in terms of, like, okay, well, who's got the cash? Trump's got the cash. I don't know if he's spending his own money like Rob Ford. I spent my own money on this. I'm a businessman. I don't need to hear this. But they're so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. When you focus on it, it's ridiculous. Like, you know, there's white lies, and then there's just blatant stuff. And if you don't, you know, if you're trying to pad your resume or whatever by making things up, brain surgeon or not, or huge businessman or not, there is a problem.
And there's a bizarre thing in the Republican Party where they think an outsider will save them politically, but they've been electing outsiders for Congress and other political seats for the last 8 years, and the one thing everyone agrees on is that Washington politics are worse than ever. So, you know, you think that at some point you'd stop believing in the virtue and the myth of the outsider. So we'll see how that holds up going forward. We're going to go to a break here, but once again, we want to remind you we have two passes for tomorrow's Guelph Lecture on Being Canadian with Jérôme Lanier, author of Economic Dignity in the Digital World, the Power of the Arts. And it's a full night of music and discussion. Always a good time. The Guelph Lecture is pretty much an institution at this point. It's been going on for, what, 20 years?
I don't know, 20, but at least 15. But
15, 20 years?
The whole list of previous lectures is on the website.
Yeah. So if you are interested, feel free to call the station now. That number is
519-837-CFRU, 519-837-2378, a $40 value.
Oh, there you go. So it'll be a good night out. Go downtown, have a bite and a nosh, and head over to the River Run Center for the Guelph Lecture on CFRU. Now we are going to go to some music and some PSAs and come back with some more issues and topical discussion. We'll be right back.
Give us the call. The tickets will be yours.
It's Steph.
I'm Jenna.
I'm Alvina.
I'm Ben, and we're hanging in the studio.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Seven, six, two, and a second later, Durant.
search. Didn't know nothing back then, didn't care. It was get it on and kick us some ass. I couldn't tell a Sunni from a Shia from the Kurds, but they educated me pretty fast. Never left Sandy back to Salt City. Never left Sandy back. Some shit went down, down in Salt City. Some shit went down in Iraq. I ain't going back. Well, it was pretty touching.
And that was a taste of Corb Lund from his new album, Things That Can't Be Undone. Corb is touring. He's not coming to Guelph. He's going to go to Toronto at some point. How dare you, Corb Lund? He's at Hillside quite a lot. Those that are Hillside aficionados will know Corb Lund for sure. That song was called Sadder City, possibly the most political song on this album. So, of course, we had to play it. And definitely an album worth checking out.
Even if he doesn't come to Guelph, loser.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
Corb, we're sorry. Please come to Guelph. Please send us your next CD, too. We don't want to get him, you know, off the list.
What list?
The list of people that send us CDs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that might be Morris Record Company anyway. There was a bit of a weird development in terms of, in terms of living. And there was a study done by a pair of Princeton researchers. They are, sorry, I had their names all queued up here. Anyway, one is Angus Deaton, and the other is Ann Case. And they published a report in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that showed a weird statistical anomaly in that it was mortality rates for white males of middle age, so between 45 and 54. We're having abnormally high mortality rates as compared to the rest of the population. The interesting thing, or the sad thing, these were high school educated white males. So there's a bit of a class distinction going on here. And it made these researchers and other people who heard about this report wonder, are we seeing a kind of side effect of what's been happening economically? You know, we're talking about people who are high school educated and perhaps not with as many options in terms of what they can do with their lives, blue collar workers, and of course there isn't a lot of blue collar work anymore, so they can't make as much money, life is not as comfortable, there's, you know, higher divorce rates, you know, life's pretty hard when you can't live even a decent life, not like a great life, but even just like decent, where you have enough money to at least have a couple of bucks in your pocket at the end of the day. So what did you take away from this, Scott?
Well, it is interesting. In researching it, it was mentioned almost through the past two or three years, there's similar studies have come out in the UK and in the United States and in Canada about this situation, in that statistical people look at it and say, oh, there's a huge jump. Another example would be just to, you know, it's not limited to middle-aged white males in terms of suicide rates, although it seems to have eclipsed, you know, car accidents in terms of killing males specifically. In, you know, another example would be in the North, Inuit youth have the highest rate of suicide in the world. It's 11 times higher than an average. So this is the thing when you're looking at numbers, if you can statistically see it, then there's definitely something going on. And I don't think it's as simple as saying that, you know, there are lots of, they call it like social determinant factors of health as to what, it's a cumulative thing, because as somebody who's had depression and mental health issues in our family, depression is generally what kills people by suicide. It is the factor. And all of the other factors is a kind of cumulative thing, as to, it's not any one thing, but as you mentioned, is economics, is it health, is it relationships? Alcohol and drugs are huge in terms of did you say coping skills? That is one of the things, the coping skills of the middle-aged male. There's also a lot of it's a very difficult thing to talk about for everyone, not just white males, but part of it are middle-aged males, but specifically white males. the suck it up culture that we've had for so many years for men in terms of not talking about things, so it lives on. I mean, it's not as if that has disappeared, and the stigma that the stigma behind it makes people reluctant to go and seek help, and that's probably part of it too. So it's a cumulative thing. It's not just, oh my God, all the middle-aged men are killing themselves. It's more like, yes, it seems to be the number one factor now, but there are many, many things that determine whether that will happen, and that's what needs to be studied further instead of just the raw number.
Yeah, there's a group in Britain called Campaign Against Living Miserably, or CALM for short, because, as you said, in the UK, they've noticed that suicide rates, not just mortality rates, suicide rates alone have increased between 2009 and 2013 with 1,000 extra deaths, plus another 30 to 40,000 attempts. And they the reasons they attach to that are increased debt, increased austerity, increased unemployment. And this is kind of a weird one. Rise in the quote-unquote gym culture and levels of unattainable physical masculinity.
Wow, so actually consider that a factor, right?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. So, you know, it makes sense.
So next time you say, I'm going to go to the gym after work, you know, keep in mind you may be affecting someone else's mental health, it seems.
Stick with your dad bod. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with getting healthy for yourself. Everyone should, you know, be healthy. And but, I mean, in terms of, like, those commercials, you know, like, you for one of that. Ready for the beach body and, you know, muscles rippling, you know, steroids and use and that kind of thing.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the pressures are huge, right?
Yeah.
From all of these sectors. But, I mean, mental health, if you're not taking care of your mental health, it probably doesn't even really matter what your physical health is, although it also affects it because it's 1 in 5 people have a mental health problem of some kind, that, another statistic for you. But then it adds up to 7 men a day.
Right.
Was that a Canadian statistic? Or I wasn't sure if that was. It must be the U.S. But
yeah,
that's 7 men a day committing suicide, and that's. I mean, that's phenomenal when you add that up. It's.
Yeah, and it's a stark reminder about how things kind of are all tied together and tied into, you know, if you don't have a job. You don't really have, first of all, you don't have money for, you know, even the necessities. You know, cost of living is always increasing, you know, housing, food, that kind of thing. So if you don't have a job, you're not living as well as you should or you need to. And if you're not, you don't have money to go out or, you know, you're really not doing much. And you're certainly not motivated to watch your own health or, you know, keep in mind that. The price of good nutritional food is more expensive than, you know, getting a box of Twinkies. You know, a bushel of apples cost $5 at No Frills, or you can get a box of Twinkies for $2. And, you know, if you're trying to stretch your money, what are you probably going to buy? That's another unfortunate fact. So it's kind of it is a stark reminder. And, of course, there's been studies, too, that junk food has an effect on your brain in terms of you know, your thinking capacity and too much sugar and all that. So, I mean, it is all tied together in a certain respect. And the hope is, I mean, these studies don't have all the answers, of course, as much as any study has partial answers. But I hope that, you know, there's something in here that says we're really suffering in terms of quality of life. And we really need to kind of watch it in terms of, you know, where things are going.
Yeah, I should mention, too, the subset among this, which has also been discussed this week, is the rate of suicide among people who served in the military in Canada, particularly in Afghanistan. And that number is 80 men over the past 13 years. The rates of people committing suicide in the Army as compared to the rest of the armed forces is 3 times higher than the rest.
Right.
And the new defense minister has, of course, said that they're going to look into this. And a lot of that, too, is like I had mentioned before about the whole man culture. But all and not wanting to discuss things, but also victims of violence and people who are involved with violence as well, the PTSD and those kinds of factors are very, very tough to deal with mentally. And of course, it creates this whole, you know, as I said, the greater body of it's not just depression, but cumulative things add up, so that they're going to try and sort of not just tackle the stigma, but tackle this issue too and see what was it that happened specifically in Afghanistan, because that seems to be the main factor that prompted this. But so there seems to be lots of studies and lots of talking going on, but whether that will tackle mental health issues remains to be seen. However, we should mention, if you yourself feel that you're in that situation, if you're having, you feel you're having a mental health problem or distress of any kind, please take the time and call the distress line Guelph. I'll give you the number now. It's 519-821-3760. 519-821-3760. Do yourself a favor and do those around you a favor. If you feel you're within that realm and you're having issues in that area, please give that number a call. They will do their best to help you.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good place to leave it on. We, speaking of health, because, I mean, it does have to do with health, the climate change. And there's a big, huge climate conference coming up in the next couple of weeks in Paris. It is the latest, I think it's the 25th of these conferences where world leaders are going to get together and talk about taking action on climate change, or inaction on climate change, as it may have been in recent years. But there is hope from the Canadian perspective, at least, that there might be more engagement on our part now that we have a government that acknowledges climate change as an issue. So we're going to briefly check in with Team Trudeau on this particular issue. Catherine McKenna, the environment minister, is already there, or has been there, to lay the groundwork for Paris.
Minister of Environment and Climate Change.
That's right.
So yep. There you go. Right off the bat there, there's something that...
Yeah,
that is significant, the fact that it's mentioned.
Yeah, and then we have Kathleen Wynne coming out the other day and saying that there will be details soon about Ontario's new cap and trade system. And at the same time, though, we have 8 billion liters of raw sewage being dumped into the St. Lawrence.
Yes.
So it's kind of like the best of times and the worst of times.
Supposedly this was Catherine McKenna's first official act as the Environment and Climate Change Minister, was giving the thumbs up to the sewage dump with conditions, though. I'm not actually sure what the conditions are. I think it was, how can we sort of monitor this and study it as to how we can do
it was,
better the next
the,
time?
Monitoring the quality, having an emergency management plan ready, and having video surveillance. So.
Because video surveillance of the steamers floating down the river.
Yeah.
And they'd said that the alternative plan, which was involving some kind of containment, either trucks or a ship, was going to be something like $1 billion, which I can't really see somehow. But I guess it's finding a ship that will just take a boatload of sewage, I guess, and then they would probably just take it on the Atlantic and dump it. That didn't happen. They said this was much easier. But again, I think this story in some way relates to climate change as well. Was it Vonnegut's birthday or something? Was it Vonnegut's line, we could have saved it all, but we were too damn cheap? This is the thing. It's kind of like, well, it's going to cost $1 billion to do this, so instead of doing that, let's just dump it. And, of course, we see the same thing with climate change, too. It's like, well, we'll just, I don't know, we'll come up with a certain level of, oh, we'll put a price on carbon, which I don't particularly agree with, but you know my politics. If you're making carbon a commodity as well, then it's still capitalist generally, right? So it wasn't taxed for years, and then you're going to make it a commodity, which is traded, and then you can buy an amount, and then you can still pollute, and I don't know. We could probably have a whole show on just carbon credits alone. But, I mean, that's their way of saying we're trying. And, you know, McKenna did say that urgent action is needed, and they want it to be grounded in what they call robust science. But it would seem that some of the flack that they're taking is that the targets that they're using are the ones that the Conservatives had anyway, which was, what was it, a 30% reduction by 2030?
It's 30% of 2005 by 2030.
2005 levels. And if you can go back in time, it was those levels. We want it to be 1990 levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never going to be Industrial Revolution 1759 levels ever again. But they just keep sort of moving the goalposts and saying, yeah, let's shoot for this one now. Oh, no, wait, we didn't. Oh, dear.
Well, that was the number the Conservatives quote on the campaign trail. Because in 2009 at Copenhagen, they send the benchmark of 17% below 2005 levels. And according to Stéphane Dion, we are nowhere even close to meeting that.
Nope.
So you can't even meet the halfway point of that. And Of course, the NDP wanted 34% of 1990 levels by 2025. So it's an even bigger goal with even less time. I don't know. It all sounds very ambitious. And especially when you're looking at the idea that no one really has the heart or the capacity to take genuine action. Like, these benchmarks keep getting rearranged and put off and changed and increased and decreased, and it just seems like there's no action ever taken. Meanwhile, things are getting worse, not better. The sewage thing, just to revisit that for a minute, that, you know, we talked about that on CFRU News the other day when I was on CFRU News. That was, I mean, as much as you want to, you know, break thumbs over, you know, a decision like that, because it sounds pretty bad. And, you know, for the environment and climate change minister, that being her sort of first piece of policy, it really was kind of a painted between a rock and a hard place on that one, because this is something that had to happen right away. It was a decision that was put back by the previous government, and because of the change in government, obviously. But urgent repairs need to be done on this interceptor. And, I mean, and also on top of it all, it's not like cities in Canada have $1 billion lying around to rent sewage ships. I don't know if that's a thing, but,
And if I got it right, this, is it Victoria and Halifax still dump all of theirs? They're not as big as Montreal, but they just dump it straight into the ocean. Yeah. No treatment.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean,
Halifax does, but if
Halifax does, I'm fairly sure Victoria does as well, which is, I mean, it's ridiculous in any instance in this day and age to be doing that, unless there was some kind of emergency like this one. Now, Coderre was on the news, and he was talking. Denis Coderre is the mayor of Montreal and longtime Liberal, right?
Mm-hmm. He was a Liberal candidate and cabinet minister.
Talking about this and saying, "Well, you know, it's gonna stink now, but the improvements will make it that much better in terms of what will be extracted from the waste stream." And that was his argument, saying, "Well, we're gonna suffer this now," and supposedly this has happened in the past too. And I think a lot of times, with capacity in that in the cities, when you have a catastrophic storm like we saw in Calgary, I mean, sewage treatment plants just overflow and go everywhere anyway.
Yeah.
But this, I mean, this was it's not preventable per se, but it sounds like there was no plan B. You know, back in, say, 1900 when they were doing that, and we need to reline the sewer, shut her off. That was one thing, but there's millions of people in Montreal now, so just in Dale. And they were trying to get people to reduce their water use and don't throw certain things down the toilet that you normally do, but that's all just, that's little teeny tiny band-aids. 8 million liters! 8 million!
Well, speaking from my somewhat limited experience in my townhouse complex and trying to get people to follow the wet-dry rules, trying to get a whole city to follow, you know, advanced sort of sewer and water management skills, you know, that has to be the ultimate in terms of will fail plans.
Yeah, the fact that we dump it all into our water supplies is kind of ridiculous if you really, really think about it. Yeah. It's like, who came up with this? You drink it and then you just go in it. It's what? It's an endless cycle.
Yeah. On the other hand, one of the things I will say about the federal government is Stéphane Dion came out, who was a former environment minister himself, said that it's not Catherine McKenna's exclusive responsibility to make sure we come up with a climate change battle plan and to execute it. He said she will succeed only if all of us in cabinet have a green orientation and sensitivity. So, I mean, so far as words go, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. To say, you know, it's all of our responsibility. We're not just putting it on her head. It's a team effort. And perhaps that'll be a trickle-down thing going into Paris. And we learned today, Justin Trudeau had a press conference, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. We should probably preface his name with Prime Minister now.
J-Dog.
Yeah, JT. Prime Minister PM JT.
PJT.
Came out and said, we're so disrespectful.
Yo, PM.
He had a press conference today and said that there will be a first minister's conference before Paris in order to get a countrywide plan of negotiation in terms of going in as a team.
And some of them are going, right? Not all of them.
Some of them,
And Elizabeth May is going.
Yeah.
Because she is the point person in
Parliament.
All
the party leaders have been invited.
Yeah. Well, she's party of one, but she is the... she's the one you would want to go.
She going?
Because she's already on the news saying it's not enough. So you need that person.
And
she's not even a contrarian. She's right. But, you know, you need that person to go.
Yeah, I think all the premiers who aren't currently involved in an election are probably are planning on
and
going.
And that's excellent because who they used to send? The junior sub-minister, parliamentary secretary of the...
Well, they would send the minister of the environment and a couple of PR guys and maybe some oil execs and... There you go. Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
Famous your aunt.
And you think he's joking. That's actually probably true.
I remember in 2007, that was pretty much all
the two guys in golf shirts at the Enbridge table. No, sorry. I can't honestly say that Enbridge were there. So, redacted.
That's all for this week on Open Sources Guelph. You can stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. You can still connect with us on Facebook. Go to Open Sources Newswire. Leave your comments and questions and requests. We love to hear from you. We are also on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. And once again, you can download the Guelph Politicast channel and hear the latest episode of Open Sources Guelph on Podbean. And listen to those episodes on wherever you listen to find podcasts. You can connect with me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson. That's my personal Twitter handle. And I, of course, have guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Google Scotty Hertz and I'll come up. I'm shortening it because I want to mention two tickets to the Guelph Lecture could be yours if you call me within the next 5 minutes because we can't do this all day. 519-837-CFRU, 519-837-2378. Two tickets to the Guelph Lecture will be waiting for you at the box office. If you call me now, they will be yours, gratis, on the house, free of charge, 7 p.m. tomorrow. Be there. Most of our listeners probably already have tickets. If you don't or know somebody that needs them, call me.
That was almost a Herlihy Boy bit.
There you go.
That old Saturday Night Live sketch with... Anyway. Google Herlihy Boy. You'll love it. Anyway, stay tuned now for DG Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back here next week with more Open Sources Thursday at 5 p.m. And now to get you up to date, we have some news courtesy of Al Jazeera. And if you don't want to stick around for the Al Jazeera, well, you can come back next week at 5 and we will talk to you then.
519-837-2378. You have 4 minutes. Guelph Lecture. Call me. Two tickets. Now.